Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts. Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It'll just have to wait, that taunting Slack. All right, well, I'm going to start, Ms. Adams. Are you there with us?
It's just like things were making noise, and I thought I had turned everything off, and I was like, what's happening? Now it's really all turned off.
Good.
Okay.
Good. You get to start.
Anyway,
today.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we try to make today make sense when I can get all of my technology to work right.
That's right. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is a hollowed out shell of a Thursday. I'm not feeling too bad, but as we have talked about before on this podcast, certainly Molly and I don't know if it's been you and me, Kimberly, but sometimes I start Thursday afternoons feeling all right, and then by the time 15 minutes are up, I want to go step in front of a bus. So, you know, we'll see how this goes.
Yeah, so I guess we'll just dive into the news fix then.
I guess we will, yes.
I don't really know what to do with that because it's there's a lot of news that is bad. And it's still interesting. It just does tend to hollow one out.
A little bit.
Mine is kind of a mix, I guess. So I'm from St. Louis, so I, of course, have to bring up the St. Louis story of the day, which is about the McCloskeys, which, if anyone cares to remember, is the gun-waving couple that basically threatened protesters who were peacefully walking through their neighborhood in St. Louis on their way to the mayor's house for a demonstration. And they brought out, what was it? I think a rifle and a pistol.
The woman had a pistol in her hand and the gentleman had a long gun. I don't know exactly what kind, but they were weapons for sure.
They were weapons. It was scary and deeply unnecessary. So today they pled guilty to misdemeanors and agreed to give up their weapons. So they did end up facing criminal charges for doing that. And so I'm just going to read this bit from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Mark McCloskey, 64, will pay a $750 fine after pleading guilty to fourth-degree assault, a Class C misdemeanor. Patricia McCloskey, 62, must pay a $2,000 fine after pleading guilty to second-degree harassment, a Class A misdemeanor. Mark McCloskey could have faced up to 15 days in jail. Patricia McCloskey could have spent up to a year behind bars. Neither will face jail time.
Isn't one of them running or talking about running for the Senate from Missouri?
Mark McCloskey is.
Yeah, I thought so.
So, you know, I guess it's good that there were some consequences for that.
Yeah.
I do not imagine that if it had been a black couple God forbid, an Arab American couple in that same situation, that is what would have happened.
Yep. 100%. This RT is an endorsement, full stop.
Yeah, it's like as much as I'm like, okay, well, at least there were some consequences as opposed to none. It's just you really see the glaring disparities.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just looking at the article. McCloskey had an AR-15 rifle.
Yeah. It's
hollowed out yet?
Well, why? Yes. Thank you. No, I just.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So so that's you. Here's mine. I'm going to get wonky in a big, bad hurry, and I'm going to talk about the Federal Reserve's dual mandate. And as we know, yesterday, Jay Powell came out and said a lot of things, one of which was, we still think inflation's transitory. We're not raising rates. We're going to, you know, we've started talking about tapering our balance sheet and all that stuff. But one of the through lines of the Fed's words the Fed chair's statement the other day was that he was really positive on the labor market, really emphasized the labor market, and more than most Fed chairs have in recent memory, talked about how important the labor market is to this recovery. And that's the groundwork for a Medium post from a couple of people who work for a group called Employ America. They are obviously pro-employment, pro-labor. They want to see more people with jobs. They have written a very long and honestly very wonky Medium post, which I cannot in good conscience recommend to your attention because it's just a snoozer. But there's a well, it is. Look,
ringing endorsement.
Look, no. But wait. My news item is not about the post itself. It's about something they say in this post. And what they say is, and this is a quote, while this newfound focus on labor market outcomes is admirable, okay, the Fed's leadership has yet to explain what labor market conditions are consistent with their estimate of maximum employment. Now, let's back up. The Fed has two mandates, right? Mm-hmm. Stable prices, which is inflation, and maximum employment. And for as long as I've been paying attention to business and economic news, it has always been inflation. It has always been those stable prices that the Fed has concentrated on, like almost to the exclusion, not quite, but almost to the exclusion of full employment. They have worried so much about inflation for a lot of reasons, right? If inflation gets out of hand, it gets out of hand in a hurry. They're all scarred by the 1970s and Paul Volcker and all of that good stuff. But now the Fed is making a turn in the person of Jay Powell in this recovery to the labor market. And I think that's really significant and really important. The thing is that the Fed has always been reasonably specific, not pinpoint specific like they have been in the last 6 months with an inflation target of plus or minus 2%. But they have reasonably been specific about, you know, we want a couple of percentage points of inflation every year. That's a good thing. It's all fine. Moderate increases prices. They have done nothing about what maximum employment means. And I think the pressure is going to increase on the Fed to start talking about what maximum employment means. Does it mean 3.5% unemployment like we had before in the before times? Does it mean 6, 8, 10, who knows? But I think it'll be really interesting to see as the Fed starts to concentrate more on the labor market, what they mean by maximum employment. And that's it. That's my rant.
Yeah, especially because their own framework for full and maximum employment has changed pretty drastically in the last year because the full, when we thought we were at full employment, and I use we very generously there, we're at full employment, we still had, you know, twice the unemployment rate for African Americans. Women were unemployed at a higher rate. Asian Americans unemployed at a higher rate. Mm-hmm. And so you had these huge disparities in the labor market, but overall low unemployment. So now the Fed is saying, well, we're going to be a bit more mindful of those disparities as we look at employment and recovery. So not only does the Fed have to communicate that they're shifting their focus from inflation to employment, but also that how they're thinking about what full employment is different than before.
Right. And also how they're publicly talking about it, right? And look, we did a lot of coverage last year after George Floyd. And we talked to Janelle Jones, who's now at the Department of Labor and a bunch of other people, about disaggregated data and how if you just give the headline number on unemployment, that's it's a completely incomplete picture of the American labor market, right? Because unemployment for Black Americans is 9-10%, right? And you just went through these numbers. And that's really the key thing here, is that to really understand what's going on in the labor market, you have to look at the whole labor market. And the Fed is turning a new page, and I will be curious to see how they do, you know?
And I would be remiss if I did not plug the series that you and I we're doing with the Federal Reserve banks called Racism and the Economy, which is taking a super deep dive into a lot of these different conversations. And they've been very, very interesting, at least to me.
they totally have been. And it's important that the Fed is actually doing these, right, at the urging of Raphael Bostic in Atlanta and Kash Kari in Minneapolis, specifically also Eric Rosengren in Boston. Because it's not something the Fed has done in the past, right? I mean, you know, you go see Rafael Bostic in Atlanta and he takes you on a tour of the Federal Reserve Bank and all the portraits on the walls are old white guys until you get into him. You know, it's just, it's fascinating.
Mary Daly,
oh, yeah,
the president of the Federal Reserve Bank in San Francisco, actually has her own podcast that she's done, which really gets into some of these disparities as well, which is fascinating listening, I should say.
Yeah, totally. All right, Juan Carlos, hit it. Move us along. Take the initiative. Carry out the plan of the day. All right, I'm going to go first because mine's a quickie and a cutie, and yours is actually much more substantive, but in a very uplifting kind of way. I found a story, saw a story in the New York Times the other day about this guy who, here's the lead of the story. The lead of the story is also the headline of the story. This is the story of a man who jumped into Lake Michigan every day for nearly a year. This guy in Chicago, in Chicago, close enough, spent...
Chicagoland.
Yeah, Chicagoland. Literally every day for a year, jumped into Lake Michigan, in part because he was bored, and then it turned into a thing, and he got musicians come out, and people come out, and they watch him, and they do this, and he does it rain or shine, wintertime or summertime, and it just hit me. It's a great, benign little, people adapt, life goes on, you do things to keep yourself entertained, and it's in the New York Times. The story of a man who jumped into Lake Michigan every day for a year. My favorite picture is the one where he's chopping through the ice. They embed a tweet, actually. It's a video of him chopping through the ice and then jumping into Lake Michigan through like a foot of ice. It's cray-cray. Cray-cray.
I have, you know, in the midst of all of the grim of the last year and a half, and some of which is still continuing, it's been wonderful to see all of the incredibly creative things that people have done that they never would have done before. And
right.
There was something I read very early in the pandemic about how in the pandemic that happened, the flu pandemic,
oh, yeah,
in 1918, that so many people had these creative breakthroughs. Artists and writers and musicians, because they were stuck someplace and couldn't go somewhere. And it continues to fascinate me what creativity comes out of all of this that we would not have had before.
Yeah.
So
for sure.
This is a lot of fun.
Yep.
My make me smile is sort of a wry smile, if
for
I
sure.
can say. So today, President Biden signed into law making Juneteenth a federal holiday. And there definitely were some people who voted against it. They didn't like the idea in the Senate. Some Republicans didn't like the title, which is Juneteenth National Independence Day. And all these other things were tied into that. But it happened. And there are a lot of people who have worked for a very long time to get the U.S. government to recognize in a more formal way that what we celebrate as Independence Day, July 4th, was really not a marker of independence for so many people. And this is an acknowledgement of that. And also it's sort of elevating something that was already being celebrated in many parts of the Black community. I say it with a wry smile because my whole Twitter feed, and I know Twitter is not the real world and we're probably snarkier than most on there, has been full of a lot of people saying like, everybody's good with these sort of laws that suppress Black votes in many states.
Yeah.
We're talking about banning the discussion of a lot of topics related to race in the history of this country in schools. And they asked for police reform, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen. But you got a federal holiday.
Yeah. It's kind of performative, that's for sure.
But I really am torn about it because I don't want to be dismissive of the many, many people who have worked hard for this.
Oh, no.
And this is very important. But yeah, and then one of my former colleagues from when my NPR days, Brackton Booker, who's now over at Politico, he writes this newsletter called The Recast. And earlier this week wrote a really thoughtful newsletter about the fear that this will just become another commercialized way for people to as you said, be performative. These companies that made all of these promises last summer that maybe aren't living up to them, or places, even some of these companies that are literally bankrolling some of these politicians that are doing things that are pretty anti-Black, now will have this. And there's just a lot of skepticism while at the same time trying to acknowledge it. And I think this is always the struggle of being Black in America, is sort of, yay, but not exactly what we really needed at the moment.
Yeah. Look, I think you could, just to your point about not wanting to diminish the work and the achievement of the people who've worked for 156 years, you know, to make this happen. I think you can be deeply cynical about the motives of the people who voted in Congress to approve this, and at the same time applaud and appreciate those who worked outside Congress to make that happen. I don't think that's cognitively dissonant, and I completely agree with those concerns, for sure.
Those things can exist at the same time.
For
exactly.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's my wry smile.
There you go. No, that's a good one. That's a good one. And it is a make me smile with a little, you know, with a wry smile, with a little asterisk. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
There we go.
Well.
Boom.
That's what I got. So don't forget to sign up for the Make Me Smart newsletter. This week, we're talking about the appointment of Lina Khan, a big critic of big tech, to lead the Federal Trade Commission. And I know that that's been a big discussion over on our tech Slack channel. And also, we're going to share a couple of dystopian novel recommendations from listeners.
We are. I don't like dystopia. Have you guys not been listening to
That's probably exactly why they are doing this, because
my whole family is watching Handmaid's Tale, and I'm like, nope, I'm out. I'm going to go walk the dogs.
Oh, no, yes. I don't watch that.
No,
that seems a little bit too close to real life.
That's what I'm saying.
Saying. No, thanks. I am going to go catch up on The Expanse, though, this weekend, because my Twitter feed has been full
of... Same.
I think they're adding both of us.
A lot of props to The Expanse. All right. Anyway, we're back tomorrow. Economics on Tap, the YouTube live stream. We're on Discord as well. 3:30 p.m. Pacific, 6:30 Eastern. Check your local listings, as they say. Otherwise, we're out of here. There we go. Boom.
Yep.
I wonder what Ben and Daniel are doing right now. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Carrera. Today's program was engineered by Juan Carlos Torrado. Bridget Bodner is senior producing today, and at some point, eventually, we'll come back here full time. You know, I don't know. I'm just a talent man.
She shows up in the Zoom meetings.
I know, right?
So that counts, right?
Yeah.
Erica Phillips writes and produces our Make Me Smart Explainers and our weekly newsletter. So, Kai, you can blame her for the dystopian novel recommendations. And you can send your reading recommendations there, too. I personally am a fantasy fan. Tony Wagner takes care of all of our podcast publishing needs, including your favorite, the show notes, where you'll find all those details we talked about today.
Mm-hmm. All kinds of good stuff.
All kinds of good stuff. Yeah.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.